Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. When we think about what drives human behaviour, Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs remind us that everything begins with the basics: food, water, and safety. Only when those are met can we move toward love, belonging, self-esteem, and ultimately, self-actualisation. Yet across the world, those foundational needs are increasingly under threat. Communities are anxious, societies divided, and as parents, our deepest fear isn't for ourselves, it's for the future of our children and theirs. My guest today understands this better than most. Terry Paul is founder and CEO of Botanical Water Technologies. As a father of two and a proud grandfather to twins recently, their arrival has deepened his sense of responsibility for the kind of world we're creating. One where safety and security can no longer be taken for granted. Terry's work goes to the heart of Maslow's first principle, water. Through Botanical Water, he and his team are delivering projects in developing countries like India and across Africa, turning water that would otherwise be wasted during food production into safe, drinkable sources. For children who once walked kilometres every day just to fetch water, missing out on school and opportunity, this work is nothing short of life-changing. Coined an aquapreneur at the World Economic Forum, Terry continues to invest his time, energy, and optimism into solutions that sustain both people and planet. Terry, you told me you look at the world as fractured and tense, that you feel the anxiety. How do you think we've ended up at this point in Western civilization?
I think we've just lost their way, and it's a global problem. I can understand in developing countries where they're at a different level. They're looking, how do we survive? How do we eat? How do we feed our family? You know, all the basic. Once you move into the developed world, why are we so fractured? We've got access to everything. You know, people cry poor, but we're not poor. I grew up in a working class family. My parents were factory fodder, you know, migrants. We were migrants. I came out as an 8-month-old child, and the older brother as a six-year-old. We sort of defied all the odds in doing what we're doing in the life that we live. But it just goes to show you in one generation that you can, if you knuckle down and you've got good core values, you can achieve a lot. And we're only just getting started.
We'll get into where you are now, but I'm really intrigued by your roots and how your migrant heritage influenced you. So those changes can be critical in a child's life coming to a new country. How did your experience, do you think, influence the way you see the world?
Well, I guess it gives you a grounding, Kim. You know, that sense of entitlement doesn't for many years exist. You really, the gift, I guess, my parents gave my brother and myself, my older brother, who's also a business partner in most of what we do. It's very traditional. We sort of divide everything down the middle, regardless of where it comes from. But I guess they gave us good decision-making, a good moral compass, and a safe place. And I think that's a really key thing that misses, that is missing and could be the root cause of some of the problems that we see happening. That, you know, if mum and dad said if we could go to the moon, we'd go to the moon because you believed everything they said. Now, that's not just me, that's a lot of families. But that environment, that ability to be in a safe place really grows good people. And then when you overlay, you know, good moral compass, good decision making, starting to learn from bad and good decisions, and then community. We didn't talk, you know, around the kitchen table in a migrant working class family. We spoke about community. We spoke about family. We spoke about a concept which is a Greek, where migrants from Greece has happened in the 50s and 60s. A lot of Italian and Greek migrants came to Australia for, you know, for a better life. And there's a concept which you may or may not know, known as philotimo, which is a Greek word. And it actually doesn't have an English translation, but basically it's around community and pride in what you do. If you did something wrong in your community, it means you don't have philotimo. If you go out into the community and do something wrong, you take all of your family, anyone with your name, and your roots come with you in that decision that you're about to make. It's not just about you. It's about how that impacts other people in your family, your brothers, your sisters, your parents, your cousins, your background even. And it's around mentality, a certain mentality. So these are the things that I grew up with. We didn't talk about money. We didn't talk about business. We didn't talk about all of those things that came along a little bit later in life. So that's my background, really. It's quite simple, humble beginnings, and we've had a go since then.
It sounds like you got set up with some really good basics, because from my understanding, foundations are the key. What do you think your upbringings actually provided you on top of the foundations that you've just explained in relation to the risks you're willing to take as an entrepreneur?
Well, yes, we live in, I live predominantly these days in what we call here startup land. So it is working with, new ideas and entrepreneurs themselves. Some of the businesses that we run and own are our own invention. Others, other people that we effectively partner with, and we go on a journey and help them achieve their dreams and have an overlay of impact. Nearly everything we do has to have a positive impact. And there is a skill set that goes with that, that you are taught when you come from humble beginnings around resourcefulness, around the ability to invent and create situations or opportunities. They're not just given to you to manage. There's a different mentality. The mentality growing up, like I look at my kids, have probably got a lot of that skill set, but you know, as we mentioned earlier, I've just become a granddad in the last week. I worry about that next generation where I may not be able to influence them because I may not be around and pass on that. And their mindset could be different. They'll come be brought up in a world where they have lots of things that I didn't have when I was a child. And their responsibility will be to manage those things and protect them and grow them and then pass them on to the generation beyond that. We were in the start with zero, make it good, protect it, and then pass it on. So there's two different mindsets here, right, operating. So that resourcefulness, that type of have no fear that you described in your upbringing is probably a skill set that I also have. To you sort of don't know what you don't know when you're growing up, and if you're in a safe place, you've got good moral compass, you respect other people, yet you are ambitious and you want to grow and develop, and it's not just about making money, it's or development, then you will go and do all the things that you describe. You will go and ask silly questions. You will put yourself at risk, and there's an element of risk, not stupid risk, but calculated risk, if you like. If you won't get anything in life if you're not prepared to take a risk. And I know in business we have almost the rule that says in terms of startups that when you get to about 70 or 80% of the equation, when you've sort of calculated, do I want to invest in this or do I want to build this, 70 to 80% is about as good as it'll get. If you keep polishing it to get it to 80 and 90 and 100% certainty, you've missed the opportunity. The opportunity is the arbitrage, is the gap between where you feel comfortable to press go and where reality is. And you may fail, and then that's where you learn.
We need to start thinking about the legacy we leave, as you were talking about with your grandchildren, the skills we teach them, how to actually face the challenges as a species. We're now on a planet that's a ticking time bomb. It's running out of resources that are definitely finite, not infinite, and we're looking for other planets to inhabit. So what do you think we need to be focusing on in relation to those future generations and what they're facing?
Future generations will be different. I mean, that's just part of evolution of the species. I guess humanity has an arrogance about it as well. You know, we try to create, whether it be through religion or other devices, an explanation of why we exist. But truly, we don't know why we exist. So humanity is always going to wrestle with that. And, you know, you talk about interplanetary travel, Elon Musk, and I love parts of Musk, but I think in other parts, he's a fractured person himself, right? He's a complex individual. But there's a guy that grew up, you know, we talk about growing up. He grew up at a time where he was reading Nietzsche, you know, as a five-year-old through and existentialism. I did a bit of philosophy at uni and stuff. I mean, you know, you read that and you get super depressed. It's sort of wondering what the hell, why we're here, and we might as well not get out of bed in the morning. So when you're brought up on a diet of that, you're going to be an interesting person. So humanity needs that explanation to exist, and religion for some is a good way to do it. And I'm not highly religious, but I've been brought up in a home that had religion in it, and I understand the mentality around why you would need that. You need, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end. But if we're truly wanting to see what happens up ahead, humanity has an arrogance about it, which says that we own the planet, and it'll always be here. And if we continue to do what we're doing to it, it may not be here. But geologically, this planet's been around for millions of years. Earth has been here a long, long time. And we could, as humans, have a finite existence. And it could be this current generation or the next one. It could be the end of the world. I mean, that's a very negative approach. But what I'm trying to say, Kim, is that we need to stop thinking about owning the Earth and owning the world and knowing everything to being actually vulnerable creatures that have attached itself to a planet and may become extinct like the dinosaurs millions of years ago. You know, they ruled the world, the Earth, until the Ice Age came along. They were all probably huddled up having a chat like us and thinking, oh, it's a bit chilly at the moment. Are you guys feeling that chill? I don't know. And then the Ice Age hit and there are no dinosaurs, despite Hollywood, where man and dinosaurs crossed over. They missed each other by millions of years. It's a myth. It didn't happen. So we need to let go of that arrogance. We need to be more respectful of the planet and the people on the planet. And we need to start to develop coping mechanisms and create an environment where we might be able to extend whatever humanity is left. Because you've got to have a macro view of the world, and then you've got to get up in the morning and just get on with and try to be the best version of yourself.
Well, there's only so much you can influence in the world too, and I've become pretty pragmatic about that myself in recent years, because if you continue worrying about the things you can't change and you don't think about the things you can actually control within yourself, that's a pretty bleak way to live a life. The one thing that stood out for me in there was when you're talking about the planet and our ownership over it, when we don't really control any of that, right? But I do know one thing, having worked with farmers for over 15 years, sharing stories about nutrient reduction and practice change and water quality and soil health and regenerative agriculture, which is something I practice myself on 10 acres. One thing I've always been passionate about is water. As an aquapreneur, how do you feel about the replenishment of water, which is vital for all life on this planet, and the future in relevance to how much we have?
Yeah, well, water is a very, very complex problem that the world faces, water scarcity and contamination. They're actually two issues. Obviously, heavily related to climate change. And people misunderstand climate change with drought and flood. But it's actually climate change is around extremities, it's extreme events. And that's what's happening with the Earth warming. The atmosphere is holding more moisture and essentially dumping more water in places. So the 100-year flood, when it happens every 1 or 2 or 5 years, isn't a 100-year flood anymore. And the same in drought-stricken parts of the world. You know, over 2 billion people, a quarter of the world's population, suffer from water scarcity on a day-to-day basis, and that will be more than half the world's population by about 2050. It's a massive, massive problem, and I don't believe governments have any ability to solve these problems in their own right. I look at events, similar events like COVID. And COVID was a moment in time. You know, a lot of unintended consequences of COVID happened. But what it showed was how governments reacted to an event like that. They basically divided and conquered themselves. If you think about it, Australia shut down as an island continent and said, look how smart we are. We don't have COVID. But it doesn't take much to just shut your borders. Then they worked out, well, how are we going to open our borders? If you remember, we're all trying to be vaccinated and got into that and delayed opening up borders when the world was already opening much earlier than us. But without getting too detailed in that, it just goes to show that big world problems like a pandemic and another big world problem like water scarcity and contamination, we're relying on the same people, the same politicians, the same bureaucrats, the same everyone to solve these big world problems. And COVID showed us in a two-year period, we're no good at it. We survived it, but it was a mess. And everyone was, you know, even Australia, you know, Western Australia decided to secede, do their own thing. Queensland and New South Wales are sort of bonded further north. Victoria was cut away. We had, I won't get political, we had Daniel Andrews, heaven help us. I could call him Dictator Dan, but I won't. You know, we had people like that and relying on those mechanisms to solve it. So water scarcity is a huge problem. Being the optimist that I am, I think there are ways that we can certainly contribute to helping the world's most vulnerable people. You know, people that get up, girls, women that walk. The statistics, you'd be devastated by the statistics, Kim. 200 million man or people hours per day, 200 million hours per day are spent by women predominantly and young girls walking long distances to fetch water for their families. 200 million hours per day. Think about this. So these are the world's most vulnerable people, young kids, girls, who then don't get to go to school because they're doing that walking. And they don't get an education. And then it's difficult to break the poverty cycle. I mean, I was a beneficiary of opened up universities. You know, my family could not have afforded to send me to university, but I was just happened to be born in a time where I could get an education. And that certainly helped my lifestyle and what I can do. So it's a matter of trying to impact and give some of that back to some of these communities. With our botanical water business, as it is, there's a huge charitable component on that where we are gifting water to hopefully millions of people in places like India, paid for by some of the world's largest corporations. We have a project we're about to launch in India, in a place called Nagpur, in a village where Microsoft, one of the world's largest companies, are paying us millions of dollars to create water on a daily basis for over 16,000 people. That project will go live in the next couple of months. It's 5 years of work to get us here. And the opportunity is that we'll be able to replicate this hundreds of times in a country like India. It's a legacy of an invention, a business that we invested in 5 years ago, where we make water from plants, from sugar, from tomatoes. It's an Australian invention that we're now gifting to the world. So it's known as botanical water. You can Google it. If you Google "we grow water," there's a website there. So this is our humble contribution. I'm off to Climate Week in a couple of weeks in New York. We'll be launching this project and also a platform that we've built to create an ecosystem around water. And we'll be presenting this to the CEO Water Mandate, where there are 480 endorsing companies. These are the world's biggest corporations. You know, we're talking about the Microsofts and the Googles and the Apples and the Gaps and the Starbucks and the Cokes and the Pepsis will all be in the audience. And we're inviting them to do what Microsoft have done in this testimonial project, to create projects around the factories and businesses that they run on a global basis. Sorry, I'm being a little bit long-winded here, but what these businesses have in common is that they have what are called water stewardship goals. So in their ESG, they've set goals that by 2030, which is not far away, they'll be either positive or net zero water usage. So if a textile or a chemical company or a data center, which is very much in the news, and this is why Microsoft have created this project, is taking water out of a community because they've got a data center in India, they're competing against those kids that are walking these long distances. So they've committed through our project to put the same amount of water, 60 million litres of water, back into that community utilising our botanical water technology. So what we've built, you're going to love this, we've partnered with a sugar mill called Manas. We've put in a machine that makes water from the evaporative condensate. So this is the byproduct of the making everyday products like sugar. We take it, we run it through a shipping container, and we create clean water like this water that I'm drinking, crystal clean water. We've been doing it in Australia for over a decade. And then we've dug a 5 kilometer pipeline to a village, created an ATM, giving the 16,000 people in that village an RFID reader, a lanyard they'll put around their necks. And the kids now won't walk long distances to fetch some crappy water. They'll actually be able to scan this, press 1, 2, 5, or 10 liters to receive their water, and then hopefully go to school for the rest of the day and get an education. That's 5 years of blood, sweat, and tears just to get it to here. But I have a saying, everyone wants to be first at going second. It's a quote that really resonates in this instance. Everyone loves the idea. The investors love it. The villagers love it. The government love it. The big corporations love it. Even the sugar mill loves it because it's taking its byproduct and creating water for its local community. But everyone has the tendency to stand back and wait for it to happen. And unfortunately, it takes crazy people like us living in startup land to invest our time and effort to make it, to prove that we're not crazy. And then the real prize is to deliver this another 500 times right throughout India to impact millions of people.
Terry, there's so many stories to explore within the story you've just told, and I can't wait to do this again if you're up for it. I'd love to follow up with you when you return from the States.
That'd be great, Kim. And thanks very much. I know we've tried to chat about a whole bunch of stuff, but I really appreciated the effort you've made to reach out, and I'm really, really happy to have met you.
Impact investor and aquapreneur Terry Paul is literally growing water for developing communities, giving children the chance to access education, security, and more importantly, hope. You'll find links to botanical water technologies and resources to connect with Terry in the show notes. And if today's conversation inspires you to explore ideas like growing food, protecting our planet, and embracing change with your children, then my early childhood approved books are a wonderful place to start those conversations. Because truly, what could be more important than connecting children with nature and this bountiful planet that sustains us all? Visit kimclyden.com to learn more. That's kimclyden.com. Until next week, let's be the change we want to see in the world.